are very happy to do this. Our time with you today will be taken into three sections. First, we're going to take a very brief 15-minute or so tour of the pyramid via slides. Second, we're going to look at a quick overview of God's plan as it is shown in the varied passageways of the pyramid. And that also will be rather brief. And then we will spend most of our time looking at particular architectural features about the Great Pyramid in Egypt and trying to tie these in with certain lessons from God's plan. So I think we'll begin immediately, but before we do that, let's not forget to bring to you the love and greetings of the Chicago Equation. I almost let that slip my mind, and that I'm very happy to bring. Marge brought the individual greetings during the testimony meeting. So if we can have the lights off and the projector on, we'll take a quick review of the pyramid itself, what it looks like, and the various passages of it. Lights off. As you first see the pyramid in Egypt, you generally are staying at a place called the Mena House Hotel. The Mena House is about a block's walk from the pyramid, and the view you get from the balcony of the hotel through the palm trees of that area show the pyramid. It's hard to believe that the pyramid is standing in complete, total desert, and yet around you, you have this greenery. This is because of the sharp division of the Nile Delta with the Sahara Desert. The Mena House is at the very edge of the Nile Delta. The pyramid is at the very edge of the Sahara Desert. Again, as you come down to the first floor, you see the pyramid, the area you're going to approach, that which has meant so much to Bible students because of its commemoration of God's plan. Of course, the local means of transportation is the camel, and you either take a camel or you walk up to the pyramid itself. The pyramid, of course, is an extremely imposing structure, going to our equivalent in American buildings, about 40 stories high, and it covers, forget how many acres of ground. The stones in the pyramid, each stone weighs in excess of a ton, and you have some stones in there that weigh in excess of 13 ton in the king's chamber itself. The construction you see around the base of the pyramid is not directly related to the pyramid itself, but are other Egyptian artifacts that have been found buried immediately adjacent. The sun boat is the large building that they are enclosing here. Coming close to the pyramid, you can see beyond it the second pyramid. Actually, on the Giza Plateau, there are 9 pyramids. There are 3 large ones, the first two being by far the most magnificent, the third pyramid being much more inferior. The second pyramid, which still has its top stone, is in direct connection with the Sphinx of Egypt. As you can see from this picture, the Sphinx is relatively small as compared to the pyramidal structure. It has been suggested by some that as the Great Pyramid represents God's plan, the second pyramid may represent the counterfeit of that plan by Satan. If so, notice how significant that the top stone is there, because Satan is the god of this world. And this then would be that great lion, the adversary who goes about as a roaring lion, guarding his masterpiece. Now we are looking at a telephoto lens of the apex of the Great Pyramid. You can notice it has not come to a peak. We'll be discussing that more in detail this afternoon as to why the top stone is missing and what significance there may be to that fact. This gives you an idea of the impression of the size of the block from which the pyramid is made. As you notice, the blocks themselves, because of the weather, have become rather rough and weather-beaten. But when you look at a picture of the facing stones, the smooth facing stones, you notice how they have retained the sheer smoothness of the base. Now we're looking directly up the pyramid. You have approached right to its base. You can see up to where the entrance is. This is the original entrance passage viewed from the base of the pyramid. To turn that perspective around, we'll come a little later and look from the original entrance down to give a height perspective. Here you find a few of the casing stones that remain. You notice the smoothness of those stones, and you can picture, if you would, the entire pyramid covered with this type of stone construction. Also notice that the courtyard in front of the pyramid is made up of very squared off blocks. These blocks have a great significance in themselves. We won't have time to go into it, but merely we'll mention here that these blocks are so shaped and the sizes are so marked as to make of the pyramid a complete sundial. During the summer solstice, as the sun hits the pyramid, the shadow on these blocks, if the courtyard was finished, it is very incomplete now, would give you the time of day at any given time by the way the sun rotates around. Here again we see the facing stones. There's a little bit of defect here in the stone, but basically they are still very sheer. Imagine, if you will, the entire pyramid covered by those stones, and then try to think of trying to remove the top stone with that for your footing. No way. We'll discuss that again this afternoon. Here we have the original entrance to the pyramid. Notice the way it is arched to show that it is a permanent type entrance. The perspective here, you have perhaps 5 to 6 feet. So you can get an idea of the immensity, if this is 5 to 6 feet, how much that is. This shows you that perspective. This is Brother Jim DeGroot seated in that archway as a human measurement. Now we are giving the perspective of the height of the Great Pyramid as viewed from the original entrance. This is Sherelle Hsu. She's standing there taking this picture, looking downward. She is at the original entrance to the pyramid. Marge is standing at the fourth entrance of El Mamun, cut in the 800s AD. Dave Nowitzki is down at the base of the pyramid, taking a picture, looking up. So this gives you a little bit of a height perspective. And yet this entrance is only at the 25th course of masonry, and you have well over 100 courses of masonry to the apex of the pyramid. You're less than a fourth of the way up the pyramid at this stage. This is the view into the original entrance, and they have this now blocked off so you cannot actually enter. This is a sample of the type of granite blocks that were found littered, as it were, in the pyramid. I believe this, Marge, you'd correct me, this is Petrie's block, is it not? Petrie's granite?
It may be one of them.
I believe this is the Petrie block that has the bore holes all the way through, 3-inch bores. Again, a view of the larger perspective of the original entrance. Now we are going in by the fourth passageway of El Mamun to the place where the descending passage, you can see it here, begins to join with the granite plot. The entrance of El Mamun in this chart goes directly across. It's just blasted and bored through the limestone. And then you finally come up with some stairways that they have built recently. By recently, I mean enough for tourists. And here is the end of the granite plot. This is the end toward the Grand Gallery, toward the south side of the pyramid. The north way comes down this direction. Now we are down in the pit of the pyramid, and this is the passage leading into the pit. The pit of the pyramid is not open to the general public, but we were able to obtain permission for Brother Dave Nowitzki, Sister Marge, and Joanna to spend some time there in the pit. In the pit itself, there is a large shaft that goes directly down some 30 feet straight out of the pit. You can just barely see it here on this chart. Marge was interested in going into that shaft because of certain granite stones that have fallen in there that she wanted to measure. The guide at first prohibited her, saying no one has been down there, but he did then permit her to go down. Again in the pit, we find, am I right, this is the blind passageway. Is that correct?
No, that's the far end of the pit, up in the upper right hand.
Oh, this is just the far end of the pit. It shows you the rough condition of the sides of the floor, and yet you have a relatively smooth ceiling. The well shaft looking up. This is the shaft that we'll be discussing quite a bit this morning. It's the bottom terminus of the well shaft with an upward view. Here you get a good perspective of the granite plug itself. It is made up actually of three stones. You see two of them here. There's a junction between two that plug this passageway. The length from here down to the far end of the plug is 179 inches, which is approximately 15 feet, the dimension of that plug. Now we're in the ascending passage. That's this narrow passage going up about 40 inches high that you have to bend over. Fortunately, you're aided now by cleats in the side and the floor and rails along the side to get your way up through this passage at light. Otherwise, an extremely dark passage, as in the days that Pastor Russell visited or the Edgar brothers. Again, a picture, different lighting situation, but of the ascending passageway. We're now in the Grand Gallery, the large room up here, looking down the ascending passage. You can see how these bows here, and yet how the height is here, 28 feet high once you enter the Grand Gallery itself. Sister Shirley is standing at the juncture of the horizontal passage that leads directly over into the Queen's Chamber and the Grand Gallery that goes up to the King's Chamber. We wanted this picture to show the perspective of these two entrances. When the pyramid was originally built, we believe that this entrance was totally covered, that the floor, which is right here, of the Grand Gallery, had a stone that went right on down and formed a complete ramp, making it contiguous with the ascending passage. And there's a beautiful lesson in that that if we have time we'll get into, showing how that while the high calling is open, the way to holiness, the way to the Queen's Chamber is closed. But once this is open, there is no direct way to go to the high calling. That these two are mutually independent of each other, shown by this stone, and the markings where that stone rested are still there on the wall surface. In the Queen's Chamber now, we are looking back across the horizontal passageway to the Grand Gallery, and you can notice here the drop where the chamber becomes 21 inches deeper at this stage. To make it easier for you today, they put a step there. That step is, of course, a modern thing that they put into the pyramid. The original was just this one 21-inch drop from a height of basically 48 to 69 inches. Now we are in the Queen's Chamber, and one of the architectural features in this chamber, we're going to discuss that this morning, is the niche. You can see it somewhat outlined here. The next picture shows it somewhat better, I think. You can see it. I'm too close to see it, I guess. But you can begin to see in the wall there, is this in here? Okay. A carved passage, as it were. This originally went in approximately, we'll go back to Sister Shirley's, our measuring rod, one sister's depth. That will give you a perspective of how far it is. It's about 20 inches, perhaps 18, 20 inches that is carved in. There is a passage going in several feet from here, but that is modern, an attempt to find additional passageways in the pyramid. This niche has tremendous significance, and we'll discuss that when we come over to looking at some of the features of the pyramid itself. Now we just want you to notice the shape of the niche. Notice its shape, its peculiar construction, the way it's overlapped, and we'll notice that feature someplace else in the pyramid as well. Also notice from here to here, the top of the niche. That's 25 inches exactly across, 25 pyramid inches. We'll discuss that also a little later. Well, here we are, another picture of the niche that shows the way it is overlapped. That's the man-made chamber later than the pyramid dug through. This again, just peering into that man-dug passage out of the niche, goes nowhere, means nothing. In the Queen's Chamber, another unusual feature is the air passageway. The ventilating holes that come into the chamber, and both the kings and the queens have proven to Bible students for some time that this was not meant to be a burial chamber. Dead bodies need no air, but rather it is something that has a living significance. The difference between the king's chamber and the queen's chamber is that in the king's chamber, these channels were complete all the way through. But in the queen's chamber, they were not complete until in 1872, they were broken through. It was about 4 inches of them that were not completed into the Queen's Chamber. A beautiful lesson how that life in the King's Chamber is complete. It's immortal. It's life within itself. Life in the Queen's Chamber is dependent upon God or Christ doing something for man, breaking the way clear. Interestingly enough, it was opened in the year 1872, 6,000 years from the creation of Adam, 2 years prior to the beginning of the times of restitution, the opening of a beginning of an air chamber. Interestingly enough, it has not yet been proven that the air chambers in the Queen's Chamber extend to the exterior of the pyramid. The ones in the King's Chamber, they have proven extend all the way through, and air flows in, especially since in 1928, Morton Edgar received permission from the Department of Antiquities to clear out these chambers, and he built some masonry. Brother Edgar built some masonry here to prevent further debris and sand from going in. So there's actually a screen from on this channel. But in going through this channel, he came within 10 feet of the end and he reached a blockage he had not been able to get through. So they are not positive. They have not found the exterior of this channel. It is projected as to where it should come out, but it has not yet been proven that the Queen's Chamber air channels actually reach the exterior of the pyramid. Now we come and we start going up the Grand Gallery. We retrace our steps through the horizontal passage and begin the ascent of the Grand Gallery. Notice now here too, the architectural style, the overlap, just like you had in the niche. And this is the comparison we want to make a little later in our discussion. A long perspective view of the Grand Gallery showing you its height and yet its narrowness. At this stage, from this wall to this wall, is 83 inches across, 84 inches across, just over 7 feet. But there are ramps along either side, and these ramps come in 20 inches from either side, making your walkway actually 42 inches. The overlaps, each time you see an overlap, are 3 inches on each side. So by the time you get to the roof, you are just under 42 inches, 41.6 inches wide at the roof, virtually the same as the distance between here. As you go up this steep passageway, and it is steep, you have the ramps along the side to put your hands on to help pull you up. And then there are handholds along these ramps. These ramps picture, we think, the promises that God gives us to grab hold on to assist us in walking upward to the King's Chamber. And the handholds particularly show this. But there are 28 of these handholds, 14 on each side. Except for one of these, we don't know the significance of these, but except for one of these, each of these handholds have a very unique feature. You can begin seeing that feature here. In addition to the handhold going in, there is a groove going up and a groove going across. I think the next picture will show it maybe a little better. You can begin seeing the shape of these grooves being the shape of a cross. And every one of these promises is dependent upon the cross of Christ. How beautifully shown in the pyramid by each of the handholds, bar one, I don't know why bar one, but each of the handholds having the same significant feature built right into it. Looking directly up now at the ceiling of the Grand Gallery, you get the feeling of the immensity of the height, you get the feeling of the 3-inch overlap, and the 42-inch wide ceiling at its apex. Just wide enough at the base between the ramps for two to walk, the Lord and you. Again, the perspective of the whole of the Grand Gallery. And the ceiling. At the end of the Grand Gallery, you come to a giant step, 36 inches high. We'll discuss this step in more detail this afternoon. The step has many significance. In the pyramid, it's necessary as we study it to think of the pyramid not from just the standpoint of one picture, but there are various pictures in the pyramid. There's chronological pictures, there's moral pictures, there's doctrinal pictures. And in the varying pictures, this pyramid, this step has chronological significance, but it also has various significance in the doctrine of God's plan. And the one we're going to treat most this afternoon will be, this shows the giant step of accepting Christ as our personal Savior. And we'll notice that in more detail as we come to the measurement of the height of that step. Now at the top of the step, you're ready to go forward into the passage that will eventually bring you into the King's Chamber. You notice this passage, the height of the various obstructions varies. You have in this passageway, you come under a large block of the pyramid into a very narrow space. That space is right between here and here, but it's only 21 inches deep. You bound out again, and you come into the antechamber proper, which is a fair-sized small room. And then you bow down a third time, and that brings you into the king's chamber. We'll be discussing that in more detail a little later. At a point in this first section, that 21-inch section, 8 inches into that section, you come where the floor changes from the limestone to the granite. You have a change in floor from limestone to granite. This is the granite here. Now this is the granite. It must be going out because this is coming then into the king's chamber. You have the limestone here and the floor changing at a point 8 inches into that chamber into granite. And there's a beautiful lesson that we'll look at on that feature. Another unusual feature we'd like you to take note of now, we'll be discussing this also in more detail in the third phase of our discussion. But this is a picture of this wall, just before you come into the king's chamber. The last thing you see before you bow down and go into the king's chamber, there are these flutes or slots, four of them, that stand in that wall. You see that, you bow under it, and you go in, and you are in the king's chamber itself. Here we are in the king's chamber. Notice the side walls of polished granite, looking out that door, back toward where the rails are and the steps leading down the grand gallery. Here we find you have to stoop over. This height here again is a very significant height. It is 42 inches that we find here. We find Joanna looking out one of the ventilating chambers of the king's chamber, the ones that had been broken through. It looks like these ventilating chambers are very large. That is only because this has been chipped away. They were trying to discover that was a passage. Actually, the chambers are 9 inches in diameter. In the king's chamber, you find the only piece of furniture in the entire pyramid, the coffer made out of polished granite, as you can see here, with a unique chip that was cut away. Some feel this was done by looters. We feel that this was original in its design, that it was designed with this particular corner missing. Because it is interesting that if you take this, the area of the king's chamber, and you divide into that the volume of this particular piece, the coffer, minus the volume of that slit, it fits exactly 144 times into the king's chamber, even as the Ark of the Testimony fits exactly 144 times into the most holy of the tabernacle. It gives you that particular extra dimension you need to make this fit exactly in the pyramid how it does. The relationships of volume in pyramid cubits in the coffer is exactly the same as in tabernacle cubits you have in the Ark of the Covenant. Again, a relationship between the pieces of furniture in the most holy condition. At nighttime around the Great Pyramid, there is a lovely display of sounds and lights in which they cast all of the pyramids in various colored lights and give the entire history of Egypt. It's a very interesting presentation. We happen to get this picture on the second pyramid, but they also have the Great Pyramid, the Third Pyramid, and the Minor Pyramids in light at night. And now finally, as we begin to leave, we come and look at the perspective of the Great Pyramid as seen over the back of the Sphinx. This is the picture you see so often on travel posters in which the Sphinx looks bigger than the pyramid. That's because you're standing maybe 20 feet from the Sphinx and 2 blocks from the pyramid. Back to the Mena house, and I believe this is the last picture that we have in this particular series showing your last view of the pyramid as we return from our brief tour. Have those lights off. With that as an overview of what the structure looks like, and just a very quick trip through the pyramid, we'll now look briefly at the general concept of God's plan as shown in the pyramid. The descending passage shows how man enters this world descending in a condition of sin, aiming toward a condition of death itself, as shown in the pit of the pyramid. As man traverses this, he comes to a place that is called the flood line. And there's a reason this is called the flood line in the pyramid. That is, if you start with Adam's creation here, at a point directly under, immediately under the entrance of the door at the base, and come out here, go up here, come down here, the pyramid inches are exactly 1656 where the flood comes in. And using this as a perspective, you can get your entire chronological survey of the pyramid based upon the flood line of the pyramid. You go down the descending passage, and the first thing that looks like it promises a way out was historically the law, pictured in the first ascending passage, the Jewish age. You have in this two pictures again, the doctrinal picture of the law itself and its functions, the chronological picture of the Jewish age. In the chronological picture, there is one thing that sometimes seems a little stretched, and we'd like to discuss that. To get the chronology of the Jewish age, you have a passageway here that is 1,470 inches long. Not quite right. 1,469 inches long. This is not the length of the law age. And I'm saying law age now as opposed to Jewish age. Because this is not pictured from Jacob's death as the Jewish age does, but from the giving of the law. But the law age, you remember, came when the law was given at Sinai, 1615 B.C. Your law age then, until Christ nailed it on the cross, was 1615 B.C. plus 33 A.D., 1,648 inches. And yet your length here is only 1,469 inches. To get that, you need to take that plug, pull it out, unplug it, put the plug at this end, and then you add that 179 inches on, and you got 1,648 inches, the exact length of the law dispensation. And sometimes as you look at that, it seems a little bit stretching it to arrive at chronology by taking a part there and saying, now I'm going to take that part and add it twice. I'm going to pull it out and then measure it. But perhaps it's easier if we think of a telescope. The length of a telescope. You take a telescope and you put it together. And it's 6 inches long. And you say, well, you got part of it inside. And so you pull your telescope out. Oh, it's 9 inches long. This is how this needs to be viewed. The plug is telescoped into the age to show the doctrinal feature that the law, which seemed to be unto life, is unto death. It stops them from going there. But to get the chronological feature, you need to look at the overall length with that plug where it belongs on the exterior, extending it, and that gives you the length of the law, 1,648 years. But, as we can see, when man tried to keep the law, and granted, always in the pyramid, pictures things divine, God's divine law. We'll find that granite picture in the divine law someplace else a little later in the pyramid. When man tries to keep the law by himself, failure. He cannot. He is blocked. The law did not bring life. And so he continues on his descending passage until along comes Christ. And Christ does keep the law. By keeping the law became a schoolmaster, as Paul says in Galatians, to lead us unto Christ. And Christ, keeping the law, earned the right to go up this passage. And he came on this passage to the level of this line, which is the 25th level of masonry, the plane of human perfection, the same as you see here in the chart of the ages in plane M. On that perfection, plane of perfection, he gave up his perfect life to open up a new and living life. Here was an old and dead way that did not lead to life. He opened up a new and living way by opening up a new passageway. This passageway is the well shaft. The top of this well shaft, we did not show it in the pictures because, in fact, you can't get to it. It's all blocked off. It's boarded off, and they do not permit anyone to go into that area. We have just written for permission on the present trip, coming in August, to get permission to go into there, but we're not at all sure that we'll be successful. But they say that the appearance there is the appearance of an explosion, as though a way is blasted open to life. And that becomes important in a lesson we'll see this afternoon on the height of the Grand Gallery. But in the meantime, this shows that Jesus opened up a new way to life. It has been speculated, and we think with quite good foundation, that when the pyramid was built, the well shaft was plugged, even as this is plugged with a granite plug. There are elements of granite in the grotto. There were elements of granite that are found here. There are elements of granite that have gotten down into here that no one knows exactly where they came from. It has been speculated that perhaps somewhere a cataclysm took place. Perhaps the time of the earthquake when our Lord was resurrected that opened up this way in the pyramid. That cannot be proven, of course. But here we have then a way to life by which first the church, through faith, comes up and through the Grand Gallery has the opportunity of approaching unto God on a higher than the 25th, a spiritual plane of existence. We notice here that this is on the 25th, which is the square of 5, and 5 you'll find is a number in the pyramid over and over and over again, even as a 5-sided structure, 4 sides and a base. The square of 5 is human perfection. But the double of that, 50, 5 times 10, is the plane of the spirit nature, even as we have it here in the tabernacle on planes K and L. So man can then, those of the church, approach unto God to a spiritual life. But what we have here in general, shown as a change of nature from earthly to spiritual, we have in particular shown here in the antechamber. The antechamber shows the bowing down in consecration as the way to this life. The going through the experiences in the tabernacle, you saw it in the holy. The experiences of the spirit begettal. On the chart, you see it on plane M. And then finally, the bowing down in death and the becoming alive in the king's chamber with Christ. For mankind, when this work is finished, but as we saw that floor of the Grand Gallery is removed so that the way is open to the horizontal passage. At that stage, mankind will be brought back by Christ to walk the way to human life. So we see the spiritual life, the spiritual salvation, the church in great company, the earthly life, the Queen's Chamber, and then we find some who accept no life into the pit and death itself. That gives us just a very rapid overview of the pyramid. We want to look now at some of the architectural features. Of all the passageways in the pyramid, we're going to postulate this question. Which passageway was most important in its construction? And you can give about 6 right answers. Because you could very well rationally defend, well, obviously this passage is the most important because if you don't get into this, you don't get into any place. It's the entrance. Everything is dependent on that. And someone else could say, well, obviously it's this passage because the object is not to get down there, it's to get up there. But well, that's blocked off. And someone else could say, well, it's the Grand Gallery that's the most important because after all, that is the big passage that leads to life. It'd be a little hard to defend that as the most important one. I guess we can't defend that one. But those we could all defend. And yet we think they're all wrong answers. We think that there is a architectural reason to state that the most important passage in the pyramid is this passage, the well shaft. The entire construction of the pyramid had to be based around that. That has to be planned first, and everything else comes second or third. Here's why. The well shaft, and we're going to notice the significance of this, goes through the grotto. The grotto is not man-made. The grotto was there. It's a cave in the earth. You notice the earth line here. This shaded area at the bottom is where the actual line of the ground comes. The rest is superimposed over the ground. And the ground rises up in steps And the grotto is right there. It's in the ground. It was natural. If the pyramid had been built 6 inches to the right, a foot to the left, this passage could not go through the grotto. You have to start with the existing thing that's there, the grotto. And everything is shaped from the grotto, upward, downward, wherever direction it goes, the grotto becomes the kingpin. This is why we appreciate the statement in Brother Edgar's writings, where he says the well shaft is the key to the understanding of the Great Pyramid. The well shaft pictures, basically, death. It pictures death in many ways, but primarily it pictures one death, the death of Christ. The death of Christ as it opens up the new and living way to life. To get the significance of the grotto, we again would like to call the attention to the masonry. The 50th level of masonry, the 25th level. The 50th level we can superimpose as plane L on the chart of the ages. The 25th we can superimpose to plane N on the chart of the ages. The level down here of the pit, we can take over to the chart of the ages and superimpose as plane R. But now we find that the grotto is neither down here, nor yet is it up here. It is in between these two. And that suggests something. That suggests, as we go to the chart of the ages, to look for something that is neither down here nor up here. And we find plane P. Plane P is the plane of typical justification. It is the plane that shows how God dealt with Israel. The blood of bulls and goats could never take away sin. All the sacrifice in the tabernacle could never remove the guilt of being born a sinner. But it could picture that removal. And the very fact that they were permitted to be actors in God's drama, picturing that removal, elevated them above man. And so we find that this same level of the grotto carried across is the identical level of the granite plug. And the granite plug, you remember, showed the divine law, the law of God. That again we see here. This is what elevated man, was this law. But in the grotto, we find this level connected with the well shaft, picturing the death of Christ. Again, let's go to our chart. On the chart, we find the death of Christ marked, obviously, by a cross. But there's two crosses. There's a cross here, and there's a cross here, showing that Jesus' death was so designed to accomplish two purposes. He redeemed all mankind because he was a substitute for Adam. That's shown right here. The substitutionary atonement, Christ dying for Adam so that man might live. But also, Israel had become under a double condemnation. They were not only condemned in Adam, they were condemned because they had said, we will keep your law, and then didn't. They were condemned under that law. And so it was necessary that Christ die as a Jew to remove the curse of the cross from Israel. How beautifully this is shown in the pyramid, where we find the death of Christ, the upper cross, here opening up the way of life, and the death of Christ for the Jew, here in the grotto, removing the curse of the law. Now notice something else. For Jesus to remove the curse of the law, it was necessary that he, as a Jew and as a perfect human being, keep that law perfectly. But the only one who could do this was, one, a man, two, a perfect man. He had to be head and shoulders above mankind, because the law was a measure of a perfect man's ability. How beautifully this is shown in that the grotto is in the earth. It is part of the earth. It is human. It is man. But it is above the earth. It is above the general level of the ground. It is the highest part of the ground, showing that he was perfect above this other. And so we find in the grotto the removal of the curse of the law, Jesus dying on plane P, taking away this guilt from Israel. Interestingly enough, Those who have been in the grotto in recent years, particularly Brothers Chaloux and Brother Tornquist, have taken pictures in the grotto, and they have found what to them. And you know, this is like you go through the Wisconsin Dells, you see those figures on the side. If you got a good imagination, that fits. What to them was the natural rock outline of a bullock, a lamb, and a cradle, a manger, which ties in exactly with this lesson, because these are the typical pictures, the plane of typical justification in the grotto. Okay, let's leave the grotto, and let's come to another architectural feature, the feature of the niche. That's what we saw in the Queen's Chamber. That unusual nothing. That unusual doorway to a blank wall. That's what it looks like. It looks like somebody planned to build a passage here and got tired and went home. He got that far in and he just stopped. I think there is a lesson to that niche that is very, very beautiful. I don't have a diagram here of the Queen's Chamber. We'll come back to that just a little later. First, we want to note that the Queen's of the Niche is identical in appearance to an end view of the Grand Gallery. They have in common this unique overlapping feature. In the Grand Gallery, this overlapping feature contains a very beautiful lesson, and that lesson we can bring over to the niche. You notice when you're in the Grand Gallery, you should have one goal, heavenward. The thought should be turned upward, laying up treasures in heaven. This is the thought of the exalted view of being channeled heavenward. And the further heavenward you get, the more it narrows in, showing conformity. It is like a funnel turned upside down, because we are funneled heavenward. We each are by nature human beings, aren't we? As human beings, we need to get rid of the excess of the flesh. The closer we come to Christ, the more constrained we are. We're forced into a mold. That's what Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5. The love of Christ constrains us. It forces our hand. It makes us get rid of the excess of the flesh, shown by this wedging in as you go heavenward. We're being brought into a pattern. The same thing will be true for mankind. When they arrive at this condition, they are going to have to be also wedged in. They also are going to have to develop the fruits and graces of the Spirit. Now, there's an interesting measurement about this niche that comes into play twice. This niche, as it comes up, finally gives you a top measurement of 25 inches exactly. 25 pyramid inches is one pyramid cubit. Doesn't that beautifully show how they would have to be brought into one measurement of a man? As in the tabernacle, a span was the measure of a man's ability. So they will have to measure up to being a perfect man. It's a 25-inch measurement precisely that they are channeled into. No matter what they start out with, they must end up there. But this niche is placed unusually. It is not placed dead center on this wall. It is offset to the south, to the north, excuse me. Offset to the north, to the right as you look at the chart, exactly 25 inches. From the center line of this to the center line of the passage is 25 inches. And in the pyramid, when we get to considering the vertical axis, we'll see anything to the south represents humanity. Anything to the north, sorry, this is north. Anything to the north represents humanity. Anything to the south represents spiritual. And so this is human perfection. It is offset to the human side. Also shown by the fact there are five courses in this process. Whereas in the church, there are seven courses in this narrowing, a spiritual completion. They are developed into a spiritual nature. Their measure is not 25 inches. Their measure is just under 42 inches. Virtually 42 inches. Why 42? Let's look at something. What is the goal of this group? They want to get into here, don't they? That's what they want to be. They want to be part of the church. They want to be part of the high calling. How do you get into there? You've got to be able to fit under these passageways. You've got to be able to go through this whole process of the antechamber and come into there. And you know what that process is? What that measurement is to permit you to get in? 42 inches. They are molded into the exact measurement necessary to bring them into and completely fill that chamber. And so we find in the grand gallery a spiritual development into the exact requirements to bring them into the heavenly salvation. We find in the Queen's Chamber of Restitution a molding into the exact requirement of perfect humanity. Beautifully shown this complete conformity to divine character in the pyramid. Now let's move into the antechamber and note two things in the antechamber. First, we want to note, we saw this on the slides, this end wall. The end wall had four vertical slots. Recall that? We saw that. We want to talk about that a little later. It's always helpful in studying the pyramid to study the pyramid in your right hand and your tabernacle in your left hand, or vice versa, because the two can be completely related to each other. Putting the tabernacle over the pyramid, the king's chamber is equivalent to the most holy. The antechamber is equivalent to the holy. The grand gallery is roughly equivalent to the court, with some exceptions. But basically, it's equivalent to the court condition. So we're here at the holy, going into the most holy. In the tabernacle, if you were to go from the holy to the most holy, what would you have to do? You'd have to bow down also, wouldn't you? You'd have to go under that curtain. What held that curtain up? Four pillars. You've got these same four pillars shown in those four striations, those four grooves that go up and down. But, someone may say, that's a good theory, but if that theory holds true, then to get into the holy, you had to go through five pillars. And you don't have any five striations, any five things here. You don't, and yet you do. And here's where they are. When you come into the antechamber, there are not only grooves along this wall, there are also grooves along the west wall. There are what appears to be four grooves, one, two, three, four, right here at this end. But actually, these are the extrusions. There are five grooves. The spaces between are the grooves. It's the wideness that is the groove there. That's the indented part. So you have the five grooves here in the holy condition, the four in the most holy. And what does that show? The same thing is shown in the tabernacle. That when we come to the holy, we come as human beings. We come with all that we have. And all that we have is comprehended in five senses. We have feel, we have sight, we have touch, we have smell. These are the things that we have. We are human. And so, Lord, take this. But to come into the most holy, he says, now, you must exchange those five senses for four attributes. Wisdom, justice, love, and power. Now, that is your guideline. No more what you are as a human, but what you are as a spirit. These are your four spiritual senses, and they're shown in the antechamber on the side and in the front. I see our chairman is here, so we will stop at this point. We have a couple lessons in this section, but I think that we'll just touch one of them briefly this afternoon and then go into discussions on the exterior and recurring measurements in the pyramid. With a map.
I feel like a villain breaking this up. This 45 minutes went awful fast. I wish that Brother Carl was around the last 2 months when I was leader. It did me, what does 1910 represent? I couldn't answer anything. So I'm sure that we probably learned more in this 45 minutes than we did in the last 2 months. I'm sure we all want to send our Christian love to the class that Carl represents. Can we raise our hands, please? As usual, we will reconvene at 1 o'clock, and I'm sure that everybody Well, I'd like to hear the balance of this pyramid study.
Have thrown a grace now to thank thee that we've had this opportunity of looking at this stone witness in Egypt. Help us to appreciate the foreknowledge that thou hast shown there by building so many of these things that we've come to appreciate to such a permanent monument. Bless us now as we break for our noon meal. Bless the food that we are to partake of. Bless the fellowship we will have together, that each of these may be used as blessings from thy hand and used to show thy glory. To this extent, we'll leave ourselves in thy care, Jesus.